Chapter 3. Nothing like a beer in a private space, eh? Flynn said. Fula's Pot only had a handful of customers this early, and when Brunt arrived, every one of them suddenly remembered pressing errands. Now, their party sat at a small, grubby table in the back of the tavern's empty common room, watching dust tumble through the thin sunbeams that trickled through the windows.
Aye, Gorm nodded.
A nervous barmaid delivered pints for Flynn and Gorm, and a cup for Gleebeck. The barkeep rolled out a couple of kegs for Brunt.
Mr. Brunt and I expected to travel all the way to Whitegeld or Manchester to find you, said Mr. Flynn. How happy to find the famous Gorm Ingerson one tier up from us.
I suppose that's one way to look at it, said Gorm.
And traveling alongside a goblin, no less. I find myself curious as to why.
I'm wondering the same thing at this point.
May I?
The Tinderkin reached across the table and plucked Gleebeck's papers from the goblin's paws.
Ah, it seems that your friend here has provisional papers. Where is he employed?
He's with me, said Gorm.
Ah, but being with you isn't the same thing as being employed by you, you see.
Mr. Flynn tossed the papers back to the goblin. Gorm met Mr. Flynn's cruel smirk with a hard stare. Without breaking eye contact, he pulled a single gilton from his money pouch, placed it on the table, and slid it to the goblin.
"He's my squire," he growled.
"Squire?"
said Gleebeck.
"Ah, but I'm not sure associating with you would be any better for our friend here."
Flynn's smile was both mirth and malevolence as he pulled a slip of parchment from his pocket.
The Heroes Guild finds several serious offenses and a whole host of minor infractions in your file. Years of heroics with an expired license, failure to procure the necessary insurance, interference with heroics in progress, petty theft, unsanctioned looting. My, my, such a long list.
Least I could do for them after what they did to me.
It seems to me they were lenient. If I recall the ballads, you fled from a quest, said Mr. Flynn.
It would be hard to recall the ballads incorrectly. Songs of Johann the Mighty were sung in every tavern and square from the Freedlands to Ruskin, and even into the Southern Empire. All of them told the story of before Johann the Mighty was the Mighty, before he slew Dotar Urmian, or the Bloodworm of Knifevale, or the Lion of Crate, when he was just Johann of Embledon, traveling into the dungeons of Azanon, the Spider King. All of his companions died or fled, the bards sang. Even a dwarven berserker ran away, they sang, but not Johann. Before that quest, Gorm had his own ballads. They called him the Northern Flame, the Pyrebeard. The berserkers called him their finest, and he was the toast of the Khazad-im clan. He'd need a caravan to haul loot back from some of his jobs, and when he had arrived in town, throngs filled the streets to scream his name. Then he took a mid-level job with some heroes to bring down a rogue Noctomancer, and everything went to the scavengers. He still wasn't exactly certain what had happened in the dungeon of the Spider King. He didn't remember much of the fight with Azanon, though it was true that berserkers seldom remember much of any fight. Still, he had flashes of memory that haunted his dreams to this day. Iheen the Red falling and bleeding, Ataya Trueheart immolated in violet flames, hideous limbs reaching for him. And the running. Gorm remembered fleeing blindly, frantically, not just from the dungeon, but for days, running from inn to inn in the grip of a terror stronger than any battle fury he'd ever known. When he'd finally calmed down enough to stop, word was already spreading about Johann, the young hero who'd slain the Spider King alone, abandoned by Gorm, with his other companions dead around him.
"The Heroes Guild could have had you killed for a deserter," Flynn continued.
The guild made a very clear distinction between common mercenaries and professional heroes. While a mercenary's loyalties were based on current market prices, a licensed hero on a quest was guaranteed to either complete the task or die trying. Whether the hero was trying to finish the quest or trying to evade guild enforcers when he or she died was totally irrelevant.
All they've given you was an act of mercy.
Mercy! Snorted Gorm. Stripped me of my rank and made me a pariah, you mean?
Dead, Gorm could have been buried with his father in a quiet ceremony. But alive, as the first berserker ever recorded to have fled from battle, Gorm was a source of shame that no clan could bear. He was cast out of the Brotherhood of Flame, and the Khazad Im clan disowned him, leaving him cold, clanless, and hungry in the streets. He'd tried finding work, but nobody wanted someone with his reputation on a quest, or even behind a lunch counter. He didn't eat for a week, and only then because some snot-nosed rank two whelp thought he could take Gorm in a fight. Gorm had lived on his assailant's provisions for a few days, and then beat up another overbold hero for more food and money. Soon, that was more the pattern than the exception, and 20 years later, here he was, a wanted vagrant traveling with a goblin. Mr. Flynn shrugged.
We could debate the merits of guild law for some time, but it's probably best if Mr. Brunt doesn't partake too much of the local brew. He's a bit of a violent drunk, you see.
Brunt finished his first keg with a noisy smack of his lips, and then eagerly twisted the tap off a waiting second.
Ah, said Gorm.
You've earned more than enough demerits and penalties for the Heroes Guild to name you a force of evil. And while I'm sure you'd be sad to hear that your indiscretions had invalidated your green friend's papers by association, if you were declared a foe, you'd doubtlessly be attending to more pressing problems, namely that guild regulations should require Mr. Brunt here to show you off for a quick, clean hanging.
I'm aware.
Of course, Mr. Brunt has never been one to do things by the book, so to speak. He's developed quite a reputation as a renegade, a lone wolf who takes justice into his own hands.
Loose cannon, rumbled Brunt.
There you are, Mr. Brunt, said Flynn happily. So you see, Mr. Ingerson, if Mr. Brunt carries out guild justice for these offenses, it will likely be a bit less quick and much less clean than a hanging.
The air rang with the crack of splintering wood as Brunt crushed his second keg against his forehead.
I see, Gorm said, watching the ogre laugh. But since I'm having a beer with you, I suppose you're here to offer me an alternative.
How very astute of you!
Flynn played with the point of his small dark beard.
You may recall that I represent the Temple of Almatra, which has a mission it considers to be of the utmost importance. Have you heard of the prophecy of the seventh hero?
I don't know much about their religion, said Gorm. Is that the one who are supposed to rise up and save the world from something, and prove that the Almatrans were right about everything after all?
More or less, said Flynn. I believe the Almatran prophecies are somewhat more specific.
Yeah, but every time one shows up, he just ends up getting himself killed. Whole party wiped on some barmy quest that's way out of their league. Last time they went to kill the Dragon of Windspar, if I remember.
Ah, well, they do say that madness finds whatever the All-Mother touches. The Temple of Almatra has had some problems in the past with misidentifying the seventh hero. It's rather tragic that hindsight has shown them all to be less than genuine. Still, perhaps this time will be different.
Gorm choked into his mug, covering himself in a spray of foam and ale.
I see you've realized the nature of our offer,
Flynn smirked.
The Almatran Temple is willing to intercede on your behalf with the Heroes Guild, in exchange for your service, of course. It seems a good deal to me.
A good deal? The Almatrans are all touched by the Mad Queen. Nobody ever takes quests for the Almatrans. It's certain death.
Oh, no, Mr. Ingerson. No, no, no.
Mr. Flynn leaned in close.
It is almost certain death. It's probable death, but there is that faint sliver of hope that you won't be asked to do anything too crazy, and that you'll make it home a tad richer and wiser. After all, Rolf the Weary was the 42nd seventh hero, and he and his party died from old age, waiting for a sign from the All-Mother.
The Tinderkin pointed upward to the vacantly angry figure of Brunt.
Now, Mr. Brunt, on the other hand, Mr. Brunt represents certain death, contractually obligated death, death backed by the laws of every government of every city of every nation on Arth.
Justice, Brunt style.
Brunt's voice was like thunder in the distance.
Right you are, Mr. Brunt, said Flynn. That, Mr. Ingerson, is certain death. And if that alone doesn't sway you, consider that the deal isn't totally one-sided. The Guild will consider you a member in good standing once again, your record erased, your back dues waived, and so on and so forth. You may even advance a rank or two. It could work out rather well for you.
Then find someone else if it's such a good deal.
I'm sure you can see the difficulties of finding willing candidates for such a quest, said Mr. Flynn.
And yet the prophecy of the seventh hero has an inherent recruitment quota. My associates and I must look for qualified and semi-qualified heroes with limited options, such as yourself.
I have options, said Gorm.
Of course. Two options, specifically. Take the quest, or face Guild justice via Mr. Brunt.
Flynn drained the last of his ale.
Choice is, as I said, a constant. But I should make it soon if I were you. Mr. Brunt is not a patient ogre.
Take matters. Own hands,
rumbled Brunt.
Ha ha! Let's hope not, Mr. Brunt. For Mr. Ingerson's sake, eh?
He placed his mug upside down on the table.
Well, what shall it be?
Gorm weighed his options. The Almatrans offered a chance to get his life back on track, but chances were far better that they'd lead him to a demise far worse than Mr. Brunt could dream up. His eyes caught Gleebeck's, and in the ignorant yellow orbs he saw a spark of fear. If Gorm was executed for a criminal, Gleebeck would be guilty by association. They'd swing from the same tree, which put them in the same boat. Unfortunately, that meant they were up the same creek without the same paddles as well.
Fine, Gorm said. Let's meet this seventh hero of yours.
Dwin Poldo set the sheet of paper back down on top of the others. He looked down at the man who stood in front of his desk, which was no small feat, as Mr. Snythe was a human and Mr. Poldo was a scribkin, or a high gnome. Standing, Poldo would have barely come up to Mr. Snythe's waist, but Poldo had compensated for his lack of height by designing a mahogany desk and chair ensemble that set him head and shoulders above anyone who entered his office. Scribkin are known for their ingenuity, not their practicality.
The numbers are not good, Mr. Snythe.
Yes, sir.
In fact, they're terrible.
Yes, sir.
And here at Goldson Bags, the numbers are everything.
Yes, sir.
So it is only logical to say that everything is terrible, Mr. Snythe.
I'm sorry, sir.
Poldo stroked his luxuriant mustache and thought furiously. The numbers hadn't been good before Mr. Snythe had come into his office with a stack of receipts from the Heroes Guild. Now the numbers were downright awful. He looked at the top slip of parchment. Fine calligraphy on a typeset template read, 7.373, 12th of Summerglow, Oppo. Receipt for the equitable distribution of assets from the hoard of one venomous chimera of the Eastern Moors. The Heroes Guild hereby holds that Goldson Bags Swampland Adventure Fund, owning 6% of the hoard, is entitled to the following. One notebook, partially used, 6 shillings 1 pence. Mr. Poldo let loose a long sigh. The other receipts were essentially the same, save that the names of the plunder funds changed, and none of the other funds got a notebook.
This hoard was projected to be valued at 50,000 gilton, Mr. Snythe.
Snythe had clearly been expecting this line of questioning.
We had it assessed, Mr. Poldo, sent a hoard adjuster out and everything.
And?
He never came back.
And you didn't see that as a problem?
It's usually a good sign, sir. The most deadly monsters have usually done the most pillaging, you see. So, when a beast takes down a well-trained hoard adjuster, it's generally expected to have more valuable loot. That's not always the case, apparently. Well, risk is inherent in the system, sir. This creature had no money.
True, sir. The Gilton is from selling its meat down at the base.
And the notebook?
It belonged to the hoard adjuster.
Mr. Snythe held up a small black booklet with an adventure capital seal embossed on its cover.
Very good condition, all things considered.
Poldo flipped the notebook open. The first page was the only one with any writing. It read, Venomous Chimera of the E. Moors,
The beast hath nothing. Ah, this would have been useful 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, sir? Yes, when our plunder funds invested some 16,000 gilton in the bloody monster's thrice-cursed hoard, Mr. Poldo shouted, slamming the notebook down on his desk. Right, sir. Poldo dismissed Mr. Snythe and polished his spectacles. He picked up a quill and adjusted his calculations. He ran the numbers again, just to be sure. They were still bad. Sighing, Poldo pulled his stepladder and climbed down from his desk. He adjusted his impeccable black suit, picked up his notes, and stepped out of his office. He quickly made his way through the familiar maze of ebony marble corridors, ignoring the clerks and agents that scrambled to get out of his way. As he rounded a corner, he extended a hand, and a leather folio was placed in his grasp before he had taken 3 strides. He lifted his chin, and an attendant ran up beside him, stooping to wax his mustache. He plucked a tumbler of mineral water from a waiting attendant's hand, drank a sip, and gargled the rest, and then handed the empty glass to a different attendant as he rounded the corner. The lift was waiting for him.
"Afternoon, Mr. Poldo," said the gnoll who ran the lift with the tip of his crimson cap.
"Good afternoon, Hrk," said Poldo, stepping into the tiny onyx room.
"Good news today?"
Hrk asked politely. Poldo shook his head.
"Well, next time," said the gnoll.
The lift's smooth black doors crackled faintly with traces of noctomancy as they slid closed. Hrk tapped a combination on a dial of runes by the door, and they rode up to the top floor in a respectful silence. Poldo stepped off the lift into a small waiting area. Across the room, massive gold and ebony doors were already swinging inward with an ominous creaking that rivaled the gates of any dark fortress. With a deep breath, Poldo brusquely walked into the top office of the Goldson Bags Group, Incorporated. The office had onyx walls and panoramic windows, and was empty save for 2 massive ebony desks. Behind them sat the 2 men often remarked to be the shortest titans on Arth, Fenrir Goldson and Bowlby Bags. A dwarf and a halfling, respectively, Goldson and Bags had dominated business in Andoran and beyond for more than 2 centuries. They continued poring over a couple of outsized ledgers until Poldo gently cleared his throat.
"Yes?"
said Mr. Goldson, not bothering to look up. He was ancient, even for a dwarf, and age had reduced his once stout figure to a wizened frame with pallid spotted skin stretched over it. His long white beard, adorned with gold and copper rings and pendants, was his only remaining hair. He wore a dark suit that looked much like Poldo's, yet cost more than a good-sized farm in the Hearthwoods.
"I have the report for tonight's meeting with the investors, sir," said Poldo.
"Excellent,"
said Bags, setting down his quill. Mr. Bags's curly silver locks settled in over a face touched by the beginnings of a grandfatherly wrinkle, and he wore a jolly smile that looked comfortably appropriate on someone of his considerable girth. He looked like a kindly old man finally enjoying all the amenities wealth had brought him, such as a suit that made Mr. Goldson's seem cheap.
"There are some serious concerns," Poldo said.
Mr. Goldson put down his pen and set his harsh gaze on the Scribkin. Poldo swallowed hard and continued,
"Adventure Capital isn't performing up to the standard that it once did."
Mr. Bags frowned.
"Our revenues are up 6% this year."
"Yes, but revenue from loot is down by 37%, sir," said Poldo, consulting his notes. "Most of Adventure Capital's profits are from selling plunder funds and their derivatives."
In Poldo's mind, plunder funds were growing a bit too popular. Everybody seemed to love buying up and bundling together the rights to shares of different hoards, creating a new financial product to invest in. The Heroes Guild encouraged upfront investment, as it could be used to pay off professional heroes, regardless of the loot a foe had. Investors were keen on spreading the risk over multiple foes' hoards. Goldson Bags and its competitors could make a profit selling shares of monstrous hoards before the monsters were slain, and eliminate the risk altogether. Poldo saw the benefits of plunder funds. However, all those reasons were built on 1 vulnerable assumption, that shares of the hoards were worth more than what a plunder fund paid for them.
"The average hoard seems to be shrinking in value," Poldo said.
"Treasure hoards don't shrink," Mr. Goldson snorted. "Drakes and scargs and chitinous scythers don't give gold away, do they? No, they attack people to take gold, and the hordes grow!
Poldo flipped through the other reports in his folio. Monster attacks are down by 5.5% this quarter, sir. A 23% decline since last year. The average quest time from offer to completion is down 63% from last year. There's been a dramatic rise in the number of Shadowkin and creatures of monstrous descent seeking to become NPCs. Foes attack less often, live less long when they do, and increasingly are joining the economy as labor rather than common pool resources. Hordes are rarer and have significantly less loot, and if trends continue, I...
Yes? Mr. Baggs prompted.
I don't think growth in the heroics industry is sustainable, Poldo squeaked.
Mr. Goldson and Mr. Baggs shared a knowing look.
Mr. Poldo, said Mr. Baggs with his kindly smile, do you think we didn't see this coming?
Oh, no, sir,
said Poldo automatically.
Our firm represents the best and the brightest minds in all the kingdom, said Mr. Goldson. Naturally, we're aware of the current irregularities in professional heroics, but we're confident the market will correct itself. We're already taking measures to help that correction along, said Mr. Baggs. But in the meantime, it's your responsibility to let the investors know that this difficult situation is temporary, Goldson continued, and that we're on top of it. Reassure them, Mr. Baggs finished.
It's a somewhat difficult point to make when our share prices are down 3% on the wall, sir.
Our share prices will rise when the investors have been suitably reassured, Mr. Poldo,
Baggs said meaningfully.
Yes, sir,
Poldo relented. He bowed as Mr. Goldson and Mr. Baggs returned to their ledgers. The Temple of Almatra was in the middle tiers of Andoran, wedged uncomfortably close to the ridge. Its grounds were overgrown with thick vines and choking weeds, and its limestone walls were pitted and covered in teal and golden lichen. A couple of green and silver banners, each bearing the All-Mother's falcon, hung from two old windows, but they had been left in the weather too long and were starting to fade and fray. It was, Gorm thought, as he was led up the wide steps to the temple, a sad state for the house of the Queen of the Gods. In the Age of Darkness, when the truth was concealed by Manon and many competing belief systems spread over Arth, most people thought that religious conflict would end if the world could be converted to one faith. Then Arth's gods and goddesses revealed themselves once more and united the world in the worship of one consistent pantheon. Religious conflicts resumed the next day. Arth's pantheon was essentially a celestial administration that the Creator had left in charge once he decided that his work was good, or at least good enough. Like middle management everywhere, the gods seemed to be mostly concerned with petty conflicts and power struggles. They fought endlessly over believers, and money, and status, and the best temples, and anything else that gods typically want. By all accounts and any measure, Almatra, the All-Mother, was not faring well. No worshippers walked the halls Gorm and Gleebeck were ushered through. The mosaics on the floor were missing chips. The murals on the wall were peeling. Some chipmunks had made a nest in the dried-up bowl of the holy font. When they reached the sanctuary, illuminated by shafts of sunlight streaming in through stained-glass windows and holes in the ceiling, a single attendant gave them a half-hearted greeting and trundled off to fetch his superiors. While they waited, Gorm examined the windows and frescoes throughout the room, Gleebeck keeping close by his side. The first window depicted a beautiful elven lady in flowing white seated on a throne next to a great gray-skinned man with a flowing beard, Almatra and Althadden, the All-Mother and the All-Father. Subsequent paintings showed them reigning as king and queen of the other gods, giving magic to men, and casting Manon from the heavens. Another window showed Althadden's betrayal, as he and the treacherous Sten were revealed to be agents of Manon. The fallen king was depicted as laughing, as great trolls slew elves and gnomes and dwarves below him, while Almatra tried in vain to stay his hand. Gorm walked along a wall, watching the rise of Tandos play out in fresco along it. Tandos, the greatest son of Almatra and Althadden,
rallying mankind to defend against the forces of Manon in the War of Betrayal, Tandos protecting the Warriors of Light as they crusaded against the vile Sten, Tandos striking down Al-Thaddon as Almatra turned away. Gorm and Glebeck were at the altar. On top of it was a great statue of two golden thrones, one empty and one with a marble lady slumped upon it. The sculpture of Almatra showed a woman racked by grief, her hair matted, and her eyes staring forlornly into the distance. A queen who held her crown in limp hands. A mother who had been betrayed by her husband, and then watched as her eldest son cut her love down and slaughtered all of his subjects. It was the kind of ugly end to a relationship that can really mess someone up. The All-Mother's descent from nobility to madness was not so much chronicled as demonstrated in subsequent murals. The scene of Tandos's ascension to divine regent showed him accepting a crown from a cat on its hind legs. The images of the first conflicts between the Almatran and Tandosian temples showed Tandos trapped in a spider's web, yet still striking at the All-Mother with a large mackerel. Almatra's fall into poverty showed her walking down a path that bore no connection to any reality Gorm had ever seen, with brightly colored flying shrimp and mocking cherubs following her through a forest of waving tentacles. The last few paintings were nonsense, a diagram of a dissected squid that had ingested a lance, an elf painted with the angles all wrong, so that both eyes were on the same side of its face. A naturalist's rendition of 37 varieties of olives, only 14 of which actually existed, according to the footnote.
"Bloody insane," Gorm muttered, staring at the olives.
"Some would say," conceded a soft voice behind him. Gorm turned to see a slight human clad in Almatran robes, all white with green and silver trimmings. He had curly ginger hair and a face that was somehow innocent and weary in equal measure. There was also an oddness about the man's face that Gorm couldn't place. "Hello," he said to Gorm. "I am Niln Ildevin of Almatra, a high scribe of her ladyship."
"Oh, Gorm Ingerson. This is my, squire, Glebeck."
"Glebeck!"
Niln nodded. "It's good to meet you, Gorm, and you as well, Glebeck." Gorm couldn't see what made the man's face seem so strange. There was nothing wrong with his nose, which was small and round, nor his jaw, aside from needing a good beard.
"Zugig, tibibit tibrin!"
I meant no offense, calling your painting insane."
"It's no matter. We know that the All-Mother has certain challenges that she struggles to overcome, as do we all. It's my eyes, by the way."
"Ah, right, that's it," Gorm said.
He supposed that he should have been more embarrassed, but he was too relieved to finally identify the quirk in Niln's face. The man's eyes were different colors, one sky blue, the other sea green.
"Sorry again."
No, I get that a lot," said Niln. "It's pretty common for those of us who are of the first generation." Humans were the most common of the races of man, by virtue of being the genetic default. In ages past, the gnomes and elves, and even the Sten, occasionally fell in love with members of a different race, and the result was almost always human. Of course, when two humans bred, and it often seemed to the elder races that they did little else, they naturally made more humans. Very few humans could recall their original ancestry. For a handful of humans, however, their heritage was much more recent. There were still times when an elf and a gnome of some sort would feel Vala's touch and start a family. The children such couples had were something close to what most humans were, but somehow seemed more ancient.
"So, you're the seventh hero, then?"
Yes, said Niln. "Well, so it is written."
"Written by whom?" said Gorm.
Written by me," said Niln, shifting uncomfortably. "Or rather, by the goddess through me."
"You're the one saying that you're this hero of legend? Sounds a bit convenient."
"I'm the High Scribe of Almatra," said Niln. "The High Priestess intercedes on our behalf, and it is I who receive her answers and accounts of history. Most likely."
"Most likely?" asked Gorm.
"There are two High Scribes in the temple, currently," Niln said with some reluctance. "It's really an unusual situation, especially as there is some
disagreement between my scriptures and scribe Pathalon's.
So what's that mean? Is the goddess supposed to be arguing with herself?
All eyes turned to the diagram of the olives.
That is a distinct possibility, Niln said carefully. But it's also possible that scribe Pathalon, with all due respect, is mistaken.
Or that ye are.
Yes.
And a pretty good one, given that you're predicting that you're a legendary hero, said Gorm. I mean, you look like you could barely lift a mace, let alone swing it when an orcish warrior or venomous scarg is bearing down on you. That counts for more than some inklings that may or may not be the ranting of the mad goddess. You're risking your life, to say nothing of my life or Gleebec's, for a pile of silly Almatran drivel. No offense.
You know, saying no offense doesn't count for much after saying something really offensive.
Fair enough. I'll stop. But face facts. You've got no strength, no experience, and you clearly have no clue what we're doing here. I mean, do you even have a quest?
Well, not as such, stammered the High Scribe. But the prophecy says
burn the prophecy. This is supposed to be professional heroics, snapped Gorm. First, you need someone to find a monster with loot, and they stake a claim on its lair. Then they issue a quest to kill the monster. Then they sell off shares of their claim to investors and use the money to hire heroes to come and kill the beast. And then they split up the loot based on who owns what stake in the hoard. That's the job. That's all it is. You've got no monster, no loot, no quest, no investors, nothing. This isn't professional heroics. It ain't even amateur heroics. You've just got some fanciful dreams of glory and the writings of a barmy goddess.
This is actually still pretty offensive, ventured Niln.
I didn't say no offense.
Niln's mouth tightened into a tiny, lipless line.
Be that as it may, I have to go on.
So how do you know what to do, or when the quest is done?
When we have saved the world.
Ha! Snorted Gorm. As though that'll hold up in court.
I think it will. Niln's brow furrowed slightly. Follow me.
The inner sanctum was a small white room with little decoration aside from a painting of the All-Mother and a silver sculpture of a strange icon, 6 silver lines radiating from a rune at the symbol's center, each terminating in a different glyph. 3 cords wove around the 6 outer runes, connecting them to each other so that the sigil looked like an intricate wagon wheel. A thick green folder inlaid with the same icon sat on a small table in the center of the room. Niln stepped up to the table and flipped open the folder to reveal a heavy document bound with black ribbons and crimson seals that depicted a dripping quill over a well-detailed skull. It was a regrettably recognizable crest.
You hired the lawyer monks of Ad-Chul?
They're said to be experts on guild law of some renown, said Niln.
That's an understatement.
The brothers of the Order of Ad-Chul once famously saved a town from flooding by drafting a cease-and-desist letter to the river. Everyone in professional heroics knew that the only way out of a contract with the lawyer monks was death, and even that wasn't guaranteed. Rumors held they had once successfully filed a motion with the gods themselves to claim a portion of a Tandosian priest's eternal reward.
The lawyer monks have drafted an agreement using a campaign structure with a set of open objectives, said Niln, carefully reading from the contract. If that isn't specific enough, just know that you'll be bound to any quests, side quests, bounties, and such that the party engages in until you are released from service by decree from the Temple of Almatra or the Temple of Tandos, or the event of your death.
The Temple of Tandos?
They funded our quest as a gesture of goodwill. Our temples are seeking to end ages of religious conflict.
That's generous.
Well, they do have a lot of money.
I meant calling it a conflict.
Long ago, the wars between the Almatrans and the Tandosians had been protracted, bloody affairs, but in recent centuries, the wars had grown progressively more petty, more lopsided, and much more succinct. The last Almatran crusade started just over 400 years ago, when the Tandosian high priest insulted the All-Mother by falling asleep during a holy ritual. The Tandosians crushed the uprising without waking him.
Hilarious, sighed Niln. Will you sign the contract and join us?
Do I really have a choice?
Mr. Flynn would say that you do, but since your only other option leads to your execution, I'd imagine you would say you don't.
And what do ye say?
I'd say you have a destiny, and choices are the steps you take to reach it.
Niln offered him a quill. Gorm took the quill and pulled the contract toward him.
You wait till you've seen a bit of the world,
he grumbled, initialing the first page of the contract.
You'll stop with such nonsense.
And what makes you think that I haven't seen enough of the world?
Gorm looked up from the contract straight into the priest's mismatched eyes.
You're still trying to save it.